But opening the show up is something very special, all right? And I got an email from a friend who said, hey, would you be interested in... I said, yes, there's no hesitation, okay? No hesitation at all. And who we're having is we're having a man named Alo Black. And he's, I don't know, I'll read this and I'll just get through it and we'll jump into it. He's a soul singer, soul artist, lyricist, vocalist, and songwriter. Joins us in studio today for Music and Conversation. He recently said, my purpose for music is positive social change. And he started as a hip-hop artist in the 1990s and then transformed from rapper to singer without discarding his hip-hop spirit and social awareness. And he's playing at the Ford Theater on July 9th, all right? That's, what, next Saturday, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's just jump into this, Alo. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I got to tell you, man, it's really interesting because when I started, you know, listening to your music, to your work, it took me in a lot of different directions, and all of which were really interesting,
great,
to say the least. But it also raised a lot of questions for me. And the first thing I want to get into with you, though, is so people know, you are going to be at the Ford Theater July 9th. Tell them what that show is.
July 9th, I'll be performing at the Ford Theater. The songs that I've chosen for this show are songs that have been an inspiration to me as an artivist, as an activist and an artist. Songs that were part of social movements of the past and a couple from the present. Songs like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi and Aretha Franklin's Think and Sam Cooke's Change Is Gonna Come. So I'm performing with about five different bands or musicians from Los Angeles, groups that I feel are very, very talented and deserve a little bit more visibility. So I bring them on the stage with me at various parts of the show to share these songs. And they are some of my favorite songs. I found myself in rehearsals getting choked up at the lyrics, and you know, these are the songs that have touched me for so many years. Now I get to actually sing them on stage.
Well, I'm glad you had the experience of getting choked up, because I have to tell you, a few of the songs that you do of your own now actually had me choked up like crazy at some points. And one we're going to talk about, a couple of them we'll talk about, but in particular, the things that happen between what the system says about people and what it does to people and how it shapes people's lives and what you say about that, right? Mm-hmm. And also the point about the Christmas song, Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. I really, we're going to go out with that, just so you know, all right? And you can tell a little story about it before we go out. But that song had me sobbing.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
That was such a beautiful piece and a very heavy piece, and it's something people need to hear. But I want to jump into what you were just talking about as a songwriter, all right? And you and artivist, okay? So you have this basic approach to things. And as a songwriter, you once said that you aim to make your music make positive social change. Let's talk about that a little.
Sure. Well, starting with the lyrics, taking cue from Bob Marley and Michael Jackson and Nina Simone, folks who would, with their lyrics, discuss the issues and present the messages that they wanted people to hear. I try to come at my music with that perspective, with the perspective of I can put these words together that'll allow people to have a mantra of self-determination and self-sufficiency. So how can I do this as well as my forefathers and foresisters did in music? And that's one way. So I do it with the lyrics. Another way is with my visibility. You know, I get to be on TV and do interviews and magazines and radio. How can I speak about the issues that mean something to me and use that time and that space as a platform? The other is with my music videos. Not all of my songs have a direct message about social transformation, so I use my music videos as an extra piece of the story. Wake Me Up was a song that was fantastically popular around the world. The story in the song is quite vague, so I made it specific in my music video visually by associating it with the fight for immigration reform in the U.S. Love Is the Answer in lyrical form is quite vague. It didn't speak to any specific topics, but in conversation with Community Coalition of South of Los Angeles, they said what would be nice is to have more awareness around what was being called willful defiance, where students were being suspended for, you know, kind of, you know, minor infractions. And those suspensions then lead to them not going to school and potentially being influenced by elements in the street. And it's a, you know, kind of a downward spiral. They call it the school to prison pipeline. So I wanted to address that in the music video. And being able to make these PSAs with my access to millions of eyeballs and millions of ears, I think is another way that I'm affecting my goal of trying to create some positive social change.
You know, it's really interesting because when you talk about millions of ears, you're literally talking about millions of ears. Mm. I mean, and your videos do, they really do bring a whole other aspect to the song. I mean, the songs themselves are beautiful and they're really very moving. You know, and just hear just your voice. We'll talk about this a little later too. Just, you know, your soul voice is yeah. very soulful and Thank really you. Just something that just penetrates people's hearts. You know, but there's also this thing of the idea that you have these videos and you actually put together a visual picture of what's going on and the impact. Like for instance, the one on Wake Me Up. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that scene there is so powerful. And folks, you have to go to YouTube. And you put in Aloe Black in YouTube, just Google that, and you're going to come up to a whole, I'm telling you, there's like truckloads of these
videos,
right? And the thing is that each and every one, and some of them are looking at it saying, 35 million people have looked at this and listened to this. And you're thinking about the broad impact you're having, but also the content of that. For instance, raising this thing of this is where you're at, this is where society's at, and how can you sit there and not step up against this when you're seeing that what's portrayed in there, that the young woman going to try and see her husband separated, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what it is. It's like it's the story of this woman and her husband's working in this country, and she's in, I guess, Mexico, and she's, you know, sitting there and she's trying to figure out how to get by. She gets picked up, you know, yeah. when she tries once, and that whole it determines everything about her life becomes this fight to do this. And meanwhile, on the other side, you're showing these human relations. And how it both tears people apart, but also how much people really, one, need each other and need each other in a bigger sense as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, finding the humanity in the story is really important, and offering that to an audience that may either accidentally happen upon the songs or purposefully seek out the videos is important. And then for those who are sort of rubbed the wrong way, it creates a tension, and they have to think about, you know, what it is that makes them feel strangely about it. And sometimes it comes up in interviews, and I get to speak my piece and hopefully educate a few people.
Well, it won't come up here, okay? No, but it's also that does say something about what you've also talked about doing with your art, which is consciously standing up against and posing your art against all the various forms of misogyny and all the other trash that gets put out as you know, music to be sold. And it's sort of aimed at shaping the thinking of a whole generation of people.
I believe there has to be a counterpoint. You know, if there is a message on the radio that says live fast, die young, then I've got to write the song that says, you know, I don't want to die young. I want to grow old and gray, you know, and have grandkids and great-grandkids. Because I believe that's important. If it's going to be primetime radio where three-year-olds are listening to this music and ingesting this and it's becoming part of their psyche, then we have to have a balance. I mean, I would prefer to not have it in primetime at all. You know, I mentioned before in a few interviews, one of the most popular songs at the radio at the time that LeBron James was in a coma from drug abuse was I Can't Feel My Face, which is, to me, kind of is really disturbing. And I look at all of the checkpoints along the way. The A&R who approved the song, the president of the record label who approved the song, the radio executive who took it to radio, the radio programmer who said, yes, this is perfect for 3-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 13-year-olds to listen to at prime time on radio. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of adults made mistakes along the path in allowing this kind of message to make it to to mainstream. I don't mind. I don't want to censor it. Create your art. Release your art. Publish your art. But the adults along the way have to check and balance when we're going to play this. It's, you know, just like television. There's a rating system, and we play certain content at different hours of the day because of who is available, who might be available to consume.
But there seems that there's something that you also pay a lot of attention to, which is, you know, you once referred to that we live in a culture of flack, and all this stuff that comes down on people. I mean, look, you know, it is so easy to hear. And I was, you know, I have to say, it's like, you know, you think of somebody like 2 Chainz and what happens to him, right? And the kind of music that he puts out. Or other people, and not saying, oh, let's attack these people, but I was thinking even in terms of how when big things happen in society, for instance, he was moved to take a stand around Mike mm-hmm. Brown. You know, mm-hmm. he was actually, and he created something that, frankly, I was surprised that he created, and brought in a lot of other people from his sort of side of the art world. But there's also this thing that you've talked about the need to really, in a cultural flack, for people like yourself and others, and for people who are consumers as well, to actually stand up and not let the profit, you know, the profiteers sort of determine what actually is it that's getting into people's heads, you know, which is extremely important.
It's really important. It's a difficult position to be in because most of my peers, and I say peers meaning artivists, don't get the opportunity to be in the public, on the public airwaves, on mainstream. So, you know, my goal is to try to bring more, you know, more people along in the ranks, it's not easy, you know, just to get in, you got to do a little dance to get in. And once you're there, how do you stay there? So, you know, Michael Jackson was good at it because he could, if you look at the lyrics on most of his songs, you could barely understand them anyway because he was always kind of, you know, grunting through his notes. But when he wrote the lyrics, they were quite special lyrics about humanity, about coming together as one, about... you know, violence and about the evils of oppression, and you know, he just packaged it in these beautiful pop compositions, you know, that made you dance first, and then eventually you got the lyric. I think that's important. Bob Marley did the same. Like, you love the way the songs start. You're dancing before you get the first lyric. But that first lyric, old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I from the merchant ships. You know how many, mm-hmm. you know how many ex-slave owners' descendants are singing those songs? Do you know? And they probably don't even realize what they're saying as they get high. But it's there. Mm-hmm. It's there.
You know, it's interesting because when you were talking about Michael Jackson, I'm going to hit at this a little bit later, but... You know, that the one song that always stands out to me in terms of one I think that shocked a lot of people when they heard it and began to hear it shortly before he died and then after it is They Don't Really Care About Us.
Amazing.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, when you look at that first, the one that's filmed here that's based in this mm-hmm. country, I mean, you see all the faces in there and you see and you hear the people singing this song and you're watching their action, and it drives home so much about the nature of this society and also the mm-hmm. character of the people that are oftentimes thrown into jail, that are also, you know, all kinds yeah. of things. It gives you a concentration of the screwed up social relations in this society. And it's a very heavy song and a very beautiful song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the one that comes to mind is from Michael Jackson is You're Just Another Part of Me, which I always thought was a love song because he says, you know, we're sending out a major love. We're sending out a major love. And then he says, you're just another part of me. So I think that's talking to, but really he's saying anyone and everyone around the world is part of me and I am part of you. Mm-hmm. And like, those are the kind of things you don't get as a kid, but when you get older and you actually look at the lyrics, but that was a big pop song. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really special what he was able to do. And I give him a lot of credit for it.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to, well, first, I should remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Aloe Black. And I want people to know how to spell your name, okay? It's Aloe Black. And check that. Go up and check that out and get to YouTube and check that out, and it's going to blow your mind. It's not like anything you've ever heard before, all right? So I want
to... You know,
go ahead.
I have to make a correction. Freudian slip. I said LeBron James. I meant Lamar Odom.
Okay.
I'm sure everybody listening knew I made a mistake because LeBron James just won.
I was just wondering.
A title.
I said,
and he is not retired, and he is not.
And he's certainly not laying down in a
dope box. No, he's not. All right. He's not. And you know, much love to Lamar Odom and all of his friends and family, and hopefully he will, you know, make it through. Addiction is really tough, and who knows what he's dealing with, you know, on a daily basis.
And it is one of the things that they actually use to sort of look. It's part of the thing about anesthetizing people. You destroy people and you anesthetize them in a certain sense. Look, it becomes very fashionable from people taking it to you know, athletes taking it to deal with pain, to other people dealing it with psychic pain, you know. And it becomes an easy way out, or even just looking for a way to have a good time, you know. And I think a lot of us have had experiences in that many times too often. You know, I want to play something. I was going to play one song, but you know, I'm really leaning against it. I want to play something that really, I want to give people a sense of, and there's a reason I wanted to do this. I wanted to play a little bit from I Need a Dollar.
Okay.
All right. And then I want to talk about that for a minute. So Teddy, that's track 6. Can you play that? And this is I Need It. There you go.
Playing it. Are we live?
Welcome back. That's I Need a Dollar, and it's by Aloe Black. And I need to talk to you about that, man. That's what I need. Let's talk about this a little bit. One thing, when I read that your influence on that, and sort of what influenced you on that?
Well, I was listening to field recordings of chain gang workers singing their own kind of made up folk songs, and I Need a Dollar was my version of one of those, you know, field songs. That was inspiring me at the time. I was going through these old, I don't know if they were Lomax recordings or who they were, but a friend of mine gave me a CD, and they inspired those lyrics. And then I started writing the song kind of as I drove around town and at different points in time. It was a song that kind of took years to write because I never thought of it as, oh, I'm going to write this and record this and release it. I started writing in 2005, just in my head as something to do, as a puzzle. And then when I went to record my second solo album in 2009, I had already completed pretty much, you know, 3 verses in my head. So I just recorded it to this jam we did in the studio. It worked.
And it's one of those songs that actually, when you think about that and when you see the video to it, then what you were talking about before, about the sort of like, you can hear that and just hear it, and you've got a whole different picture of it. And then yet when you see the video, it brings in that aspect. And that's what really caught me about this thing of the, you know, listening to the chain gang songs and the farm worker and the worker songs in the fields and stuff, right? And all these kinds of things that actually depict an entire life. And somebody, a friend of mine was Oscar Brown Jr. when he, you know, years ago, and he used to talk about how that influenced him as well. These, you know, following, listening to these songs of chain gangs and the kind of the shared misery, but also the shared defiance in a certain sense, you know. And it's very, that really got me. And I really wanted to play that because that song and your influence around, you know, what influenced you was really important. And I think that comes to another question, which is the fact that you're a soul singer and you started out hip hop.
Yeah.
And also started out. Why the hell did you ever think the trumpet would be the easiest thing? This isn't a real question. Because I got to tell you, when you said, because it only had 3 keys. I did that once, and my nephew gave me a trumpet. And he said, here, you can learn that. And I tried to learn it, and it's still sitting in a case, right?
Yeah, no.
It's not as easy as it looks.
It really isn't as easy as it looks, and you have to keep it up because the muscles that play the trumpet are, you know, finicky. You lose them if you don't use them.
Yeah. Well, you never had them. You can never play. Anyway, you once said that when you're coherent and sober and sane and conscious, you need to have music that sustains that kind of mentality. And when you look at songs like Wake Me Up, and you look at songs like what we just played, when you look at I Need a Dollar, you look at, let's see, well, Life's So Hard, mm-hmm. All these songs, all of these songs, you look at them, and it is that thing, there's a constant, sort of feeding of the need to actually do that sustenance.
Yeah. When you're young and carefree, there's a time for party music, and then when you get older and you have responsibilities, you still need music. It's sort of the last playground for adults, and mm-hmm. but we want to have fun, and there are moments for abandon, but then there are moments for educating and for consoling and for embracing. So I recognize that what I feel good doing is there's a lack of in the marketplace, in the major music marketplace. There are plenty of people in the underground and indie scene doing it, as long as I've got a foot straddling both worlds, I'm going to try to push as much of the of my voice in through the mainstream airwaves.
Now, Teddy, I want you to play another song for a minute, all right? It's track 4, and it's called Hello World, and I want to move into a whole other subject off mm-hmm. of that one.
Hello World, it's nice to meet you. I've been waiting for this moment to come my whole life. Hello World, the past is over. It's time for us to come together and make the future right. I had an epiphany one night, looking at the endless star-filled sky.
All right, that's Allo Black with Hello World, and we're talking with Allo Black in studio today. Now, Allo, one of the things that really caught me about this is, and you've paid a lot of attention to this, there's a certain way that people are portrayed,
mm-hmm.
and there's a certain way, and especially people, to be frank, there's people from black and Latino children. From yeah. the moment people are born, the way they're portrayed, the kind of box that they're kept in, what's expected of them, and then what happens to them. And this song in particular, it's such an amazing piece because on the one hand it's like a soul anthem in a certain sense when you hear this thing. But there's also, when you look at the video, something cracks open.
Yeah.
And it really, and you've done a number of pieces like that where you actually are trying to deal with this thing of, the system says that people are just bad by nature of who they are.
Yeah.
By the nature of who they are. But then you're arguing that actually there's these different relations in society that people have
totally
operating within.
Totally different relations. I mean, first of all, the music video was a response to the verdict in the Trayvon Martin case, and so we had the characters in the music video wearing hoodies. You couldn't see their faces. You assume what media has conditioned you to assume. But when you think about it, for any parents out there who have a 13-year-old, when your child was in a hoodie, did you assume that they were going to do something negative? Did you assume that they were bad kids? Probably not. So to what extent should, anyone else think the same? And to what extent should our judicial system not protect the innocence of youth, the ignorance of youth, the mistakes of youth?
Well, when you think about that, though, too, because in that video, what you see is exactly that, what you're just talking about. But then you also see, and I have to tell you, folks, you see a bunch of kids in hoodies and black hoodies running through a little liquor store food mart and piling chips and sodas and all this other stuff in. And it's just like, the first thing that comes to somebody's mind, I think, in a lot of ways, if you are conscious of how this works in society, it's like, oh, wait a minute, he's portraying these cats wilding or something, you know, like that kind of, they're just going through and they're just ripping stuff. Or you see the guy standing outside in his hoodie, and that young woman is with a baby in a stroller, you know, and you think, and he's reaching in, he's getting something, is he going to jack her or something? What's going to happen here?
Yeah.
But then all that gets turned around, and it really says something to me that you're able to actually, you know, you look at this and you kind of pull things back and in the end show the humanity of all these people, and in a really powerful way. You know, it's a very powerful thing that happens at the end, and particularly when you see they're people of all nationalities, they're this, they're that, they're doing all this, and they're actually doing things that are different social relations to a certain extent, you know, than what has been expected in terms of what we think. You know, what we think when we, and it's true, when you this society, what people are told to think is that, particularly if you see a Trayvon Martin, he's up to something bad. You see any, you know, you see Michael Brown walking down the street with headphones on, and goes into a shop, has a little back and forth, whatever it is. You know, we still don't know what's true about what happened there, but you know, then he's portrayed, and the attempt is to portray people as just over the top gangsters that really don't have a right to live anyway.
You know?
And it's very heavy what you did with that.
I mean, it's extremely heavy. A note is black males only make up about 5 or 6% of the U.S. population, you know. And when you consider the effect that black males have had on popular culture, from music to entertainment, and then that you also consider the lack of control that we have over really ultimately the final kind of implications that are made about what is black maleness, you know, especially on the film and TV side, because when you see it, it's much more visceral. And so if you have no relationship to, let's say, the black community or communities of color, what you see is what you expect and imagine. You know, for in the 80s, for a young kid from the suburbs, say, you know, put a white kid from the suburbs growing up who's going to become a cop, and he grew up in the suburbs, white suburbs, and in the 80s he's watching the news and watching the media. When he becomes a cop as an adult and his only experiences with blackness are through the media, his expectations are going to be completely skewed. We're talking about a very small portion of our population in this country, 6%. And the demonization of this 6% is unfathomable.
Yeah, absolutely. And look at the percentage. What's the percentage of the people that are in prison that are black?
Yeah, it's I don't know the exact percentage, but definitely the disproportionate amount.
Well, black and Latino together is 50% or more. Mm. When you look at that. And this is, you know, it's an incredible situation that you're talking with. And that's why I think this point about actually really pulling back the cover on this. And you do a similar thing with Love is the Answer, the video for Love is the Answer. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, again, you show two brothers who have choices. One chooses to hit the books and to do, you know, to play football and do this. And the other brother is living a life and constantly, any life. It's not presented as a criminal life. It's presented as a kid who does anything. I mean, you know, if you were a kid that, I mean, I did plenty of things that, you know, were similar and would not have been, you know, I wouldn't have been treated the same
right.
way. But you're looking at this, and it isn't really a choice that guy made. And people always say, well, he chose to do that. But there's certain social relations in society that determine what you do, the choices you have available to make.
Right. Know? I mean, I don't know where the statistic is or where the science is from. I just heard it. So if somebody knows, you know, you can correct me on it. But they're saying that our brains aren't fully developed until age 21. So to expect a 13 or 14-year-old to act in a way that is, you know, completely adult-like, you know, he's still got 7 years left on that, so.
Yeah, and some of us get to be, like, much older than that, and we still
are still not fully developed. Yes, I totally agree. You get about 70 years to figure it out.
There you go. All right, I'm going to announce the show again, and then I want to talk to you about one more question, because I could spend the hour with you. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, the show is at the Ford Theater. All right, it's the Ford Signature Series. Allo Black is performing, and you got a whole crew of people there, the Brothers Band, the Concentrates, Fabiano de Massimento.
Massimento.
The Jarocho Band, the Son Jarocho Band.
Called Cambalache.
Cambalache. Soul Rock Fusion Group, the Brothers Band. all of this, folks. And it's Saturday, July 9th at 8 p.m. at the Ford Theater, all right? And if you stay tuned when we do the fund drive, when we actually start fundraising, you'll be able to get some of the tickets to that. You'll be able to purchase that as some of the premiums, all right? So, and it's really, it's going to be an amazing concert. I'm going to be there. Nothing's going to keep me out. Even if you assign people to keep me out, brother, it's going to happen. Okay?
Right. I'll tell you two of my favorite songs for the show. One I'll be doing with Fabiano is called Someday We'll All Be Free by Donny Hathaway.
I know that
beautiful
song very
song.
Well. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And another with the Brothers Band, a lesser known song by Eugene McDaniels called The Parasite, which to me is probably the best out of all message songs about our history as Americans. Probably the most on point. If you get a chance to look it up, The Parasite by Eugene McDaniels. I'll be singing that one as well.
Actually, I'm going to have you come back sometime, because when I looked at your influences and stuff, and I wanted to know why you chose soul to be a soul singer, and Eugene McDaniels, when somebody asked you, said, what are some unusual people that maybe people wouldn't think about? And you said Eugene McDaniels, and you're about the third person I know besides myself that said Eugene McDaniels.
Right.
So it's really heavy. I want to, real quick, everything that we've been talking to also is related to the song Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. Can you talk about, just tell people what that is and what led to it, and then we'll start playing and you can leave, and thank you very much.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was really moved by the death of Michael Brown. I happened to be home and had TV on and watching the news and seeing what was happening as it was unfolding, and then going online and seeing the kind of, you know, cell phone footage that people were showing, and it really upset me. And I thought, this is, you know, it's unfortunate as we got closer to the holiday season, I just started thinking about all the people who are gone and how their families are probably feeling right now as we're celebrating, you know, family during the season. And, you know, Black Friday is trying to sell us our happiness. And I just had to take a moment and pause and send a message out to the families who had lost loved ones. So Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown is the title, but in the song I kind of pay my respects to, you know, the families of Sandra Bland and of Oscar Grant and
Eric Garner,
yeah.
I mean, it's just
Freddie Gray.
And especially you think Freddie Gray, in terms of even they can't even prosecute the cops.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's insane. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for everything you're doing, and hopefully you'll come back, man. We'll get a chance to spend a little bit more time. All right?
Thank you.
All right, thanks. I love great talking with you, man.
It's really great.
And hopefully I'll see you on next Saturday, man.
Yeah, right, that'd be great if you come through.
All right.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. Put the angel on your tree. Won't you please accept this gift of Michael's memory from me? Merry Christmas, Mrs. Garner. May your family always cherish every holiday smile and laugh that you ever shared with Eric. Dear Geneva, how I wish you a holiday full of love and joy and cheer.
All right, that's Alo Black with Merry Christmas, Mr. Brown. And I'm telling you, folks, a beautiful, beautiful piece. Look it up on YouTube. You'll find it. And check this cat's workout and be at that show, all right? All right, I'm very pleased. Well, first, let me tell you, we do need you to step up and call. We extended that interview because it was really that important. So give us a